It all started so well for Solomon. The golden child of David and his beloved Bathsheba, he outlived three of his older brothers, all of whom died violently. He reigned over a united and prosperous Israel, thriving under the trade agreements and foreign tributes organized by his father. He hosted visits from foreign rulers, most notably the Queen of Sheba, who was bowled over by both his opulence and wealth. "How the mighty have fallen" is actually a quote first heard in the Bible. David speaks it when his closest friend Jonathan is slain in battle. He might have well used it to describe his son and heir. Things are about to go south for both Israel and its monarchy. My name is Chaz Bayfield, and this is Holy Bible Episode 79, 1,000 Wives. Hello and welcome back to my very slow journey through the Bible. And if you're a regular, do let me know how it's going. You can leave stars on most podcast apps to register either your delight or disdain. If you're new, it's good to have you on board. We're knee-deep in the books that relate to the history of Israel's kings, which is a lot more exciting than it sounds. After the relatively passive reign of Solomon, things are about to liven up a little. Quick note, if you're expecting a Bible study, this isn't it. It's more of a literary review of the Bible or a sightseeing tour. Some people might find this sacrilegious, but my belief is that the Bible is for everyone, not just religious people. I'll leave you to make your own mind up whether it's all actually real or not. Okay, on with the show. Solomon is at the end of his reign and is slowly losing the plot. England's King Henry VIII had a lot of wives, Solomon is in a whole different league. Israel's king amasses an astonishing 700 wives, all of whom have a royal connection, suggesting that the marriages are to consolidate political alliances. The king also has, wait for it, 300 concubines in his harem, and it appears that many of these women are actually loved by him. In his later years, this closeness begins to have an effect on his loyalty to God, as he drifts slowly away from the kind of relationship which his father enjoyed with the creator of the universe. He even goes as far as to follow the goddess Ashtoreth and the god Molech, deities detested by God, thinking nothing of building pagan altars to Molech, the Moabite god Chemosh, and any number of deities worshipped by the women in his life. According to the first book of Kings, God is not at all pleased with this particular king. Despite appearing to him twice in his life to affirm the great things which will be his, should he keep up his side of the bargain, God has now seen enough. No longer having any faith in Solomon, he vows to tear the kingdom out of his grasp and hand it over to one of his minions, only deferring punishment during his lifetime because of his love for David. The account of Solomon's wives suggests that it is the king's age that makes him susceptible to the persuasion of his younger wives, the suggestion being that a trusting older man is easier to manipulate and coerce. All is not lost, though. Solomon's family will retain one tribe so that the promises made to David that his descendants will rule forever can come true. However, it is the beginning of the end for Israel. Readers are told that God makes sure Solomon's successor has his fair share of adversaries, and the new king will be forced to watch as most of Israel abandons him to go it alone. The pace then picks up as the first book of Kings describes how a child escapee from David's attacks on the Canaanites grows up to be a credible adversary to Solomon. One of David's many successes involved the defeat of the kingdom of Edom, in which 18,000 soldiers were killed. The account of the battle in the Bible reads like a footnote, but readers learn here that David's commander Joab spent 6 months in Edom with his army, making sure every man was killed. However, a child from Edom's royal family escaped the rout and fled to Egypt with some of the country's royal officials. The boy is called Hadad, and when he arrived in Egypt, Pharaoh took pity on him, presenting him with a house, land, and provisions. Hadad grew up an Egyptian and impressed Pharaoh so much that he gave him his wife's sister as a bride. The couple lived in the royal palace and raised a family until Hadad heard that both David and Joab were dead. He asked Pharaoh for permission to return home, but the king was at a loss as to what the young man might find in Edom that he couldn't get in Egypt. Meanwhile, another survivor from David's all-conquering army makes himself known. Rezon is from Zobah, one of the kingdoms commandeered to help defend Ammon against David's army. Head back to episode 71 for a recap. After Joab destroyed Zobah's army, Rezon escaped and gathered people around him. Together, Hadad and Rezon seized the Aramean city of Damascus and between them caused problems for Solomon throughout his reign. However, the most significant threat to Israel's national security comes from one of Solomon's own officials, a rebel called Jeroboam. Solomon can see the man's potential as a leader while work is being done on Jerusalem's terraces and walls, placing him in charge of all forced labour in the region of Ephraim and Manasseh. One day, Jeroboam is on his way out of the city when he has an unplanned meeting with a prophet from the former sanctuary city of Shiloh. The Jews' sacred chest, the Ark of the Covenant, may have long since moved from here to Jerusalem, but there is clearly still a religious community at Shiloh. The prophet is called Ahijah, and he takes his brand new cloak, then rips it into 12 strips, each strip representing the 12 tribes of Israel. He tells Jeroboam to take 10 pieces for himself, as God is going to hand him 10 of Israel's tribes. He explains that God is doing this to punish Israel for its flirtation with pagan gods. However, to honour the promise made to Solomon's father David, the family will hold on to the tribe of Judah and the city of Jerusalem. Ahijah explains that God will allow Solomon to rule the entire kingdom for as long as he lives. After all, this is what he promised to David. Once the king is dead, though, all bets are off. His son will lose almost all of his kingdom and will be left in charge of one solitary tribe, so that David will always have what Ahijah describes as a lamp in Jerusalem. Even maths klutzes can work out that 10 plus 1 equals 11, not 12. So where is the missing tribe? And what about the tribe of Levi? The answer is that Levi remains spread among the tribes, and Benjamin is so small that it barely counts, and so is bundled in with Judah. It's an incredible commission for Jeroboam. If he doesn't drop the ball and does whatever God tells him, using David as his role model, he is told that his kingdom will be as enduring as David's own dynasty. It's a big if. And a huge amount rides on Jeroboam's ability to channel his inner David. The move appears to be an attempt to humble David's descendants, but only temporarily. Solomon isn't taking any chances, though, and when he gets wind that Jeroboam is plotting to replace him, he tries to have him killed. One step ahead of the king, his rival flees to Egypt, waiting for Solomon to die before he makes his move. After 40 years on Israel's throne, Solomon dies, leaving his fabulous kingdom to a son who has absolutely no idea what to do with it. As far as the writer of the first book of Kings is concerned, there is no more to be said about Solomon's reign, especially as his life has already been chronicled in a separate book, now sadly lost. Solomon has chosen his son Rehoboam to be his heir. Though less profligate than his father, Rehoboam still has 18 wives and 60 concubines, and the new king-in-waiting travels to Shechem, a former sanctuary town that has not featured in the Bible since the time of the Judges. Here, Rehoboam assembles the leaders of Israel's tribes to pronounce himself their king. This city in the north of Israel is one of several disgruntled religious centres that have been displaced by Solomon's temple in Jerusalem. And coming here to be recognised as king is a smart move by Rehoboam. Being made king here will appease the northern tribes who feel that the whole of Israel has centred around Judah ever since the reign of David. At the time, Jeroboam is still biding his time in Egypt, but he clearly has a reputation for wisdom and leadership, and so the assembly sends for him. Once he arrives in Shechem, he appears to have the backing of Israel's tribes, who stand with him as he takes their grievances to the king. Jeroboam promises Rehoboam the undivided loyalty of all the tribes, but only if he puts an end to the heavy yoke of forced labour favoured by his father. It's a perfect opportunity to win people over and to give the kingdom a much-needed fresh start. Rehoboam asks for 3 days to make his decision and consults first with the wise old men who advised his father, one of the wisest men who has ever ruled. The men's advice is to give a little to get a lot. Rehoboam needs to act like the people's servant and concede to their demands. That way, they will act like his servants forever. Rehoboam appears to be just going through the motions by consulting the old guard. None of what these grey hairs have to say will sway him from the opinions of the peers who he grew up with and who he consults next. These hot-headed and entitled young men suggest that Rehoboam should be even more ruthless than his father. He is to tell Israel that his little finger is thicker than his father's waist, suggesting that his weakest part is mightier than Solomon's strongest. The new king is to promise his people that he will rule even more harshly than his father, a man whose excessive taxation and enforced labour programmes paint him more as a tyrant than a kind and fair ruler. The advice these sadistic young nobles give Rehoboam is brutal. He is to tell his people, "My father scourged you with whips, I will scourge you with scorpions." 3 days later, the tribes gather again to hear their king's response, and his decision to make their lives harder than it was under Solomon's rule is hugely disappointing for them. The book explains that all this is God's doing in order for the prophecy made by Ahijah to come true. Israel's leaders feel that they have been abandoned by the house of David. Believing that they no longer have any share in the promises made by God to David, they tell Rehoboam that he is on his own. Only Judah remains under Rehoboam's rule, and as the assembly disperses, the king has failed to grasp that he has just lost over 90% of his kingdom. The penny finally drops when Rehoboam sends Adoniram, the official in charge of forced labour, to put the king's scourge in motion. In a defiant act of anti-monarchist feeling, Adoniram is stoned to death. Sensing the very real danger that he is now in if he remains in Shechem, the king escapes in his chariot to the relative safety of Jerusalem. There has been tension between Judah and the rest of Israel since David's time, but now the split appears final and the two opposing forces never reunite. Israel's tribal leaders are unanimous in inviting Jeroboam to be their king. Only Judah remains loyal to Rehoboam. Apparently still in denial, Rehoboam musters an army from the tribes of Judah and Benjamin and enters into full-on civil war against the 10 rebel tribes in the hope of winning back their territory. The battle never happens. The book describes how a prophet called Shemaiah hears a message from God telling Rehoboam not to fight against his Israelite brothers. According to Shemaiah, this is God's doing. The prophet approaches the king and, either because he believes in God or sees the folly of taking on a much larger army, Rehoboam puts down his guns. There are winners and losers on both sides. Israel has strength in numbers and gets to plot its own course with God at the helm, but no longer has access to the fabulous temple nor the city of Jerusalem. Meanwhile, Judah's isolation and small numbers have weakened it dramatically, but the city and temple are theirs, as is the royal bloodline. Inept as he is, Rehoboam is a grandson of David, keeping the train that promised that king an unending bloodline very much on the tracks. It makes sense for Jeroboam to remain in Shechem, as the town is in his own tribal country of Ephraim, ensuring him local support. He fortifies the town and also builds up the Transjordanian city of Peniel to ensure that the land across the Jordan is defended too. Jeroboam's biggest worry is that his people will inevitably return to Jerusalem to honour the three major Jewish festivals, Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles, and that by doing this, they may well be swayed by Rehoboam and switch their loyalty to Judah's king. If this happens, the outlook for Jeroboam is not great. The people will no doubt kill him as a traitor and reunite under Rehoboam. Cut adrift from Jerusalem and its temple, Jeroboam improvises his own northern worship sites. For some unknown reason, the king doesn't attempt to recreate the temple or even the tabernacle, despite there being clear instructions in the Jews' holy writings of how to do this. Instead, the king fashions two large golden effigies of bull calves and tells his people that these, not God, are the gods who brought them out of Egypt. He sets up one at Bethel on the southern border with Judah and the other in the very north of the country, in Dan, possibly at the pagan shrine described back in the Book of Judges. This reckless decision is in direct contravention with the Ten Commandments that forbid anyone to construct any kind of idol, and the book acknowledges that Jeroboam's actions are most definitely seen as a sin. It is well known in Jeroboam's time that God forbids this kind of behaviour. When the Israelites were so fearful that Moses might never come back down from Mount Sinai and Aaron built the people a golden calf to worship instead, God was ready to destroy every last one of them. It's a catastrophic start to Israel's independence, but Jeroboam seems intent on distancing himself from the God worship of his southern neighbours. While his people make regular pilgrimages to their two new worship sites, their king heaps coal on his already semi-heathen fire by building shrines on hilltops, another Jewish taboo. As if any more proof were needed that Israel's ruler has truly lost the plot, Jeroboam appoints priests who aren't Levites to oversee these. The king introduces a new festival, a month later than the Festival of Tabernacles, which he celebrates at the Shrine of Bethel by offering sacrifices to the golden calf there. Israel's new worship sites, their officials, and the events that take place here are all man-made. There is no suggestion that Jeroboam is either asking God for guidance or listening to his advice. Consequently, readers who are in tune with the overarching narrative of the Bible that good things happen to those who follow God can expect to see Jeroboam's reign coming to a premature end. Just two generations on from David, the monarchies either side of the border appear to be in freefall. And so, in just two generations, the glorious kingdom and united tribes of Israel are in chaotic disorder. The country now has two kings, two distinct territories, and two separate worship centres. From here on in, the books of Kings toggle between events in Judah and those to the north in Israel, as one kingdom struggles to keep David's bloodline afloat, while the other descends into ever greater depravity. Holy Bible is written and produced by me, Chas Bayfield, with music by Michael Old and John Hawkins Music. Cover art is by Lisa Goff. Do feel free to send us a message. Any feedback is welcome. Contact@holybible.com. I'll be back next time. Thanks for listening.